had managed to cobble something together that, with a little goodwill, might be termed portraits of Robert Carlson, based on random, hasty conversations with friends and acquaintances. A nice guy, always willing to lend a hand. Tragic. Harry had read through them with a fine-toothed comb, but was unable to find anything of value. No one had contacted the parents, and Aftenposten was the only newspaper to run a quotation from John. Incomprehensible, was the brief caption, under a picture of a man with a bewildered expression and tousled hair in front of the army apartments on Göteborgata. The article was written by an old friend of Harry's, Roger Giendem. Harry scratched his thigh through a tear in his jeans, thinking he ought to have put on some long johns. On arriving for work at 7:30, he had gone to Hagen to ask him who was leading the investigation. Hagen had looked at him and replied that he, together with the chief superintendent, had decided that Harry would lead it, until further notice. Harry had not asked for an elaboration of what until further notice meant. He nodded and left. From 10 o'clock onward, 12 detectives from Crime Squad, plus Beate Löhn and Gunnar Hagen, who had wanted to come along for the ride, had sat in discussion, and Thea Nielsen's assessment from the previous evening was as accurate as before. First of all, they had no witnesses. None of those who had been in Egatorga had seen anything of value. The closed-circuit TV footage was still being checked, but so far nothing had been found. None of the employees they had spoken to in the shops and restaurants on Karl Johansgata had noticed anything unusual, and no other witnesses had come forward. Beata, who had been sent pictures of the spectators by Dagblatter the night before, had reported back that they were either close-ups of smiling girls or panning shots that were too indistinct to get a decent look at facial characteristics. She had magnified sections of the latter, highlighting the audience in front of Robert Carlson, but she hadn't spotted a weapon or anything else that would identify the person they were searching for. Second, they had no forensic evidence, except that the ballistics expert at Krimtechnisch had established that the projectile that had penetrated Robert Carlson's head in fact matched the empty casing they had found. And third, they didn't have a motive. Beate Löhn finished, and Harry turned it over to Magnus Skara. This morning I spoke to the boss of the Freitech shop on Kirkevejen, where Robert Carlson worked, said Skara, whose surname, with fate's usual impish sense of humour, meant to roll your R's, and indeed he did. She was devastated and said Roberts was a person everyone liked, full of charm and good cheer. She conceded he could be a bit unpredictable, not turning up for work on the odd occasion, but she could not imagine he would have any enemies. Same comments from those I've interviewed, said Halvorsen. During the discussion, Gunnar Hagen had sat with his hands folded behind his head, watching Harry with a tiny expectant smile, as though he were at a magic show and waiting for Harry to pull a rabbit out of a hat. But there was nothing, apart from the usual suspects, the theories. Guesses, Harry said. Come on, you're allowed to make asses of yourselves. After this meeting is over, permission is withdrawn. Shot down in full view of everyone, in one of Oslo's busiest areas, Skara said. There's only one line of business that does this kind of thing. This is a professional hit job to deter others who don't pay their drug debts. Well, said Harry, none of the undercover guys in narcotics has seen or heard of Robert Carlson. He's clean. No priors, nothing. Has anyone here heard of drug addicts who have never been arrested? Forensics didn't find any illegal substances in the blood samples, Beata said, nor was there any mention of needle marks or other indications. Hagen cleared his throat, and the others turned around. A Salvation Army soldier would not be involved in that sort of thing. Go on. Harry noticed red patches developing on Magnus Skara's forehead. Skara was short and stocky, an ex-gymnast, with smooth brown hair and a side part. He was one of the youngest detectives, an arrogant and ambitious arrivist, who in many ways was reminiscent of a young Tom Voller, but without Voller's very special intelligence and talent for police work. In the last year, however, Skara's self-confidence had evaporated somewhat, and Harry had begun to think it was not impossible that they would make a decent policeman out of him after all. On the other hand, Robert Carlson had an experimental bent, Harry said, and we know that addicts can serve their sentences in Freitech shops. Curiosity and accessibility are a bad combination.
Exactly,
Skara said, and when I asked a lady in Freytex whether Robert was single, she said she thought so, even though there had been a foreign girl in a couple of times asking after him. But she seemed too young. She guessed the girl came from somewhere in the former Yugoslavia. Bet you she's Kosovar Albanian.
Why is that? Hagen asked.
Kosovar Albanian. Drugs.
Whoa there, clucked Hagen, rocking back on his chair. That sounds like gross prejudice, young man.
Right, Harry said, and our prejudices solve cases, because they are not based on lack of knowledge, but on actual facts and experience. In this room we reserve the right to discriminate against everyone, regardless of race, religion, or gender. Our defense is that it is not exclusively the weakest members of society who are discriminated against.
Halverson grinned. He had heard this rule before.
Homosexuals, true believers, and women are, from a statistical point of view, more law-abiding than heterosexual men between 18 and 60. But if you are female, lesbian, and a Kosovar Albanian with religious convictions, the chances that you are drug-dealing are nevertheless a lot higher than for a fat, Norwegian-speaking, male chauvinist pig with tattoos all over his forehead. So if we have to choose, and we do, we bring in the Albanian woman for questioning first. Unfair to law-abiding Kosovar Albanians, of course. But since we work with probabilities and limited resources, we cannot afford to ignore knowledge wherever we find it. If experience had taught us that an unexpectedly high percentage of those we arrested at customs at Gare de Morne Airport were wheelchair users, smuggling drugs in their orifices, we would put on rubber gloves, drag them out of their chairs, and finger-fuck every single one of them. We just keep our mouths shut about that sort of thing when we talk to the press.
Interesting philosophy, Hole. Hagen checked around to gauge the reaction among the others, but the closed faces told him nothing.
Well, back to the case.
Okay, Harry said. We'll continue where we left off, searching for the murder weapon, but the area will be increased to a radius of 6 blocks. We'll continue questioning witnesses and take a trip around the shops that were closed last night. We won't waste any more time on closed-circuit TV footage. Let's wait until we have something specific to look for. Lee and Lee, you have the address of Robert Carlson's flat and the search warrant. Gerbitsgata, isn't it? Lee and Lee nodded. Check out his office as well. You may find something of interest there. Bring any correspondence and hard disks here from both places so that we can see who he's been in contact with. I have spoken to Kripos, who contacted Interpol today to find out if there are similar cases in Europe. Halverson, you're coming with me to the Salvation Army headquarters later. Beata, I would like a few words with you after the meeting.
Get going!
Scraping of chairs and shuffling of feet. One moment, gentlemen. Silence. They looked at Gunnar Hagen. I can see that some of you are coming to work in ragged jeans and items of clothing advertising what I assume is the Volarinja soccer team. The previous boss may have approved of that, but I do not. The press will be following us with Argus eyes. From tomorrow, I want to see clothing that is whole and intact and does not display advertising slogans. The general public is out there, and we want to be seen as neutral public servants. And I would ask all of you with the rank of inspector or above to remain. As the room emptied, Harry and Beata stayed behind. I'm going to draw up a document for all inspectors in the unit, instructing them to carry weapons, starting next week, Hagen said. Harry and Beata both looked at him incredulously. The war is heating up out there, Hagen said, raising his chin. We have to get used to the idea that weapons will be a necessity in the police force of the future. And then high-ranking officers will have to set an example and show the way. A weapon must not be an unfamiliar item, but a normal tool of the trade, like a cell phone or a computer. Okay?
Well, Harry said, I don't have a firearms license.
I assume you're joking, Hagen said. I missed the test last autumn and had to hand in my gun.
I'll issue a license. I have the authority to do that. You'll find a requisition order in your mailbox here, and you can pick the weapon up. No one will be exempt. That's all.
Hagen departed.
He's out of his mind,
Harry said.
What the hell do we need guns for?
Time to patch our jeans and buy a gun belt then, eh?
Beata said, with a glint of amusement in her eyes.
I wouldn't mind a look at the pictures Dagbladet took of Egatorge.
Help yourself.
She passed him a yellow folder.
May I ask you something, Harry?
Goes without saying.
Why did you do that?
Do what?
Why did you defend Magnus Skala? You know he's a racist, and you didn't mean one iota of what you said about discrimination. Is it to irritate the new POB? Or make sure you're really unpopular from day one?
Harry opened the envelope. You'll get the photos back later.
He stood by the window of the Radisson SAS Hotel on Holbergsplatz, looking out over the white, frozen town at the break of day. The buildings were low and modest. It was strange to think this was the capital of one of the richest countries in the world. The Royal Palace was an anonymous yellow construction, a compromise between a pietistic democracy and a penniless monarchy. Through the branches of the naked trees, he glimpsed a large balcony. The king must have addressed his subjects from there. He raised an imaginary rifle to his shoulder, closed one eye and took aim. The balcony blurred into two. He had dreamed about Georgi. The first time he had met Georgi, he had been crouching by a whimpering dog. The dog was Tinto, but who was this boy with blue eyes and blonde curly hair? Working together, they had managed to get Tinto into a wooden box and carry it to the town vet, who lived in a grey, two-room brick house in an overgrown apple orchard down by the river. The vet had diagnosed dental problems and said he was no dentist. Besides, who would pay for an aging stray that would soon lose the rest of its teeth? It would be better to put it to sleep now to avoid the pain and a slow death by starvation. But then Georgi had started crying, high-pitched, heart-rending, almost melodic crying. And when the vet had asked why he was crying, Georgi had said perhaps the dog was Jesus, because his father had told him that Jesus walked among us, was one of the humblest of us. Well, maybe even a poor, pathetic dog that no one would give either shelter or food. With a shake of his head, the vet had called the dentist. After school, he and Georgi had gone back to see a tail-wagging Tinto, and the vet had shown them the fine black fillings in the dog's mouth. Although Georgi was in the grade above him, they had played together a few times after that. But it lasted just a few weeks, because the summer vacation had begun. And when school started up again in the autumn, Georgi seemed to have forgotten him. At any rate, he ignored him as though wanting nothing to do with him. He had forgotten about Tinto, but he never forgot Georgi. Several years later, though, during the siege, he had come across an emaciated dog in the ruins at the southern end of the town. It had trotted over to him and licked his face. It had lost its leather collar, and it was only when he saw the black fillings that he had realized it was Tinto. He checked his watch. The bus to take them to the airport would arrive in 10 minutes. He grabbed his suitcase, threw a last glance around the room to make sure he hadn't forgotten anything. Paper rustled as he pushed open the door. He looked down the corridor and saw the same newspaper lying outside several of the rooms. The picture of the crime scene on the front page met his eyes. He bent down and picked up the thick newspaper bearing a name in illegible Gothic script. While he was waiting for the elevator, he tried to read, but although some of the words somehow reminded him of German, he understood next to nothing. Instead, he flicked through to the pages referred to on the front. At that moment, the elevator doors opened, and he decided to put the large, unwieldy newspaper in the garbage can between the two elevators. But the elevator was empty, so he kept it, pressed the ground floor, and concentrated on the pictures. His eye was caught by the text beneath one of the pictures. At first, he didn't believe what he was reading. But as the elevator jolted into action, he realized something with such horrible certainty that he went dizzy for a second and had to support himself against the wall. The newspaper almost fell out of his hand, and he didn't see the elevator doors opening in front of him. When, at last, he did look up, he was staring into the darkness, and he knew he was in the basement and not in reception, which for some strange reason was floor one in this country. He stepped out of the elevator, and the doors closed behind him. In the dark, he sat down and tried to think clearly, because this upset all his plans. The airport bus left in 8 minutes. That was all the time he had to make a decision. "I'm trying to look at some pictures here," Harry said in desperation. Halverson peered up from his desk opposite Harry's. "Be my guest. Stop snapping your fingers, then. Why do you do that?" "This?" Halverson looked at his fingers, snapped them and, a little abashed, laughed. "It's just an old habit."
"Oh, yes?"
"My dad was a fan of Lev Yashin, the Russian goalkeeper in the 60s.
Harry waited for him to go on.
"My dad wanted me to be the goalie at the Steinscher Club, So when I was small, he used to snap his fingers between my eyes, like this, to harden me, so that I wouldn't be afraid of shots at goal. Apparently, Yashin's father had done the same. If I didn't blink, I got a sugar cube. The words were followed by a moment of total silence in the office.
You're kidding, Harry said.
No, nice brown sugar.
I meant the snapping. Is it true?
Absolutely. He did it all the time. During mealtimes, when we were watching TV, even when my pals were there. In the end, I started doing it to myself. I wrote Yashin on all my school bags and carved his name into my desk. Even now, I always use it as my password on computer programs or anything that needs one, despite knowing that I am being manipulated. Do you understand?
No. Did the snapping help?
Yes. I'm not afraid of shots coming at me.
So you...
No. Turned out I had no ball sense. Harry pinched his top lip between two fingers.
Can you see anything in the pictures? Halverson asked. Not when you're sitting there snapping your fingers and talking.
Halverson gave a slow shake of the head. Shouldn't we be on our way to the Salvation Army headquarters?
When I've finished. Halverson!
Yes?
Do you have to breathe so... weirdly?
Halverson clamped his mouth shut and held his breath. Harry's eyes shot up and back down again. Halverson thought he caught a hint of a smile, but he wouldn't have put money on it. Now the smile was gone, replaced by a deep furrow in the inspector's brow.
Come take a look at this, Halverson.
Halverson walked around the desks. There were two photographs in front of Harry, both of the crowds in Egertorge.
Can you see the man with the wool hat and neckerchief at the side?
Harry pointed to a grainy face.
He's right in line with Robert Carlson on the very edge of the band, isn't he?
Yes,
but look at this picture. There. The same hat and the same neckerchief. But now he's in the middle, right in front of the band.
Is that so strange? He must have moved to the middle to hear and see better.
But what if he did that in reverse order?
Halverson didn't answer, so Harry went on.
You don't change a place at the front for somewhere by the speaker where you can't see the band, unless you have a good reason.
To shoot someone? Cut the flippancy. Okay, but you don't know which photo was taken first. I bet he moved to the middle.
How much?
200.
Done.
Look at the light under the lamppost. It's in both photos. Harry passed Halverson a magnifying glass.
Can you see any difference?
Halverson nodded slowly.
Snow, Harry said. On the photo with him at the side, it's snowing. When it started in the evening, yesterday, it didn't stop until well into the night, so that photo was taken later. We'll have to call that Vedlog guy from Dagbladet. If he was using a digital camera with an internal clock, he may have the precise time the photo was taken.
Hans Vedlog from Dagbladet was one of those who swore by single-reflex cameras and rolls of film. Hence, as far as the timing of individual photos was concerned, he had to disappoint the inspector.
Okay, Hall said. Did you cover the concert last night?
Yes. Rudberg and I do all the street music stuff.
If you use rolls of film, you must have crowd shots lying around somewhere, right?
Yes, I do. And I wouldn't if I used a digital camera. They would have been deleted already.
That's what I was wondering. I was also wondering whether you would do me a favor.
Yes?
Could you check your film from the day before yesterday to see if you can find a guy with a wool hat and a black raincoat and a neckerchief? We're poring over one of your photos right now. Halverson can scan it in and send it to you if you're near a computer.
Harry could hear from Vedlog's voice that he had reservations. I can send you the photos, no problem. But checking them sounds like police work, and as a press guy, I don't want to get any lines crossed here.
We're a little short on time, I'm afraid. Would you like a photo of the police suspect or not?
Does that mean you would let us print it?
Yep.
Vedlog's voice warmed up. I'm in the lab now, so I can check right away. I took loads of pictures of the crowd, so there's hope. 5 minutes.
Halverson scanned the photo in and sent it, and Harry drummed his fingers while they waited.
What makes you so sure he was there the evening before?
Halverson asked. I'm not sure of anything, Harry said. But if Beate is right, and he is a pro, he would have done a reconnoitre, and preferably at a time when conditions were as similar to those of the planned hit as possible. And there was a street concert the day before.
The 5 minutes came and went. 11 minutes later, the phone rang.
Vedlog here. Sorry. No wool hats and no black raincoats.
and no neckerchief.
Fuck, Harry said, loud and clear.
Apologies. Should I send them over so that you can check them for yourself? I had the lights focused on the audience that night. You'll have a better view of the faces.
Harry hesitated. It was important to decide how time was allocated, especially in these critical first 24 hours.
Send them and we'll look at them later, Harry said, on the verge of giving Vedlog his email address. By the way, better if you send them to Lurn at Krimtechnisch. She's got a thing about faces. Perhaps she can see something.
He gave Vedlog the address. And I don't want my name mentioned, okay?
Of course not. It'll be an anonymous source in the police force. Nice to do business with you.
Harry put down the receiver and nodded to a wide-eyed Halverson. Okay, Junior, let's head for the Salvation Army headquarters.
Halverson glanced over at Harry. The inspector was unable to conceal his impatience as he scanned the bulletin board and the announcements about visiting preachers, music rehearsals, and duty rosters. At length, the uniformed, grey-haired receptionist was finished with incoming phone calls and turned to them with a smile. Harry told her the purpose of their visit in swift, concise terms. She nodded as though she had been expecting them and gave them directions. They didn't speak as they waited for the elevator, but Halverson could see the beads of sweat on the inspector's brow. He knew Harry didn't like elevators. They got out on the fifth floor and Halverson followed Harry at a canter through the yellow corridors, which culminated in an open office door. Harry came to such an abrupt halt that Halverson almost crashed into him.
"Hello there," Harry said.
"Hi," said a woman's voice. "Is it you again?"
Harry's sizable figure filled the doorway and prevented Halverson from seeing who was speaking, but he noted the change in Harry's voice.
"Indeed it is. The commander?"
"He's waiting for you. Just go in."
Halverson followed Harry through the small anteroom, with a quick nod to a small girl woman behind a desk. The walls of the commander's office were decorated with wooden shields, masks, and spears. On the well-stacked bookshelves were carved African figures and pictures of what Halverson supposed were the commander's family.
"Thank you for seeing us at such short notice, Herr Eckhoff," Harry said. "This is Officer Halverson."
"Tragic thing," said Eckhoff, who had got up from behind his desk and indicated two chairs with his hand. "The press has been on our backs all day. Let me hear what you have so far."
Harry and Halverson exchanged glances.
"We don't wish to go public with it yet, Herr Eckhoff."
The commander's eyebrows sank menacingly close to his eyes. Halverson released a silent sigh and prepared himself for yet another of Harry's cockfights. But then the commander's eyebrows shot back up.
"Forgive me, Inspector Hole. Occupational hazard. As the commanding officer here, I sometimes forget that not everyone reports to me. How can I help?" "In a nutshell, I was wondering whether you could imagine any potential motives for what has happened."
Of course, I have thought about this. It's difficult to see any causes. Robert was a mess, but a nice boy. Quite different from his brother."
"John isn't nice?"
"He's not a mess."
"What sort of messes was Robert involved in?"
"Involved? You're suggesting things of which I know nothing. I meant that Robert had no direction in his life, unlike his brother. I knew their father well. Joseph was one of our best officers, but he lost his faith."
"You said it was a long story. Would it be possible to have a short version?"
"Good question."
The commander heaved a heavy sigh and gazed out the window.
"Joseph was working in China at the time of the floods. Few there had heard about our Lord, and they were dying like flies. No one, according to Joseph's interpretation of the Bible, would be saved unless they received Jesus. They would burn in hell. He was distributing medicines in the Hunan province. The flood waters were full of Russell's vipers, and many people had been bitten. Even though Joseph and his team had taken a whole chest of serum with them, they tended to arrive too late because the snake has a hemotoxic venom that dissolves artery walls and makes victims bleed from the eyes, ears, and all other orifices, killing them within 1 or 2 hours. I was myself witness to the effects of this venom when I was working as a missionary in Tanzania and saw people bitten by boomslangs. A terrible sight."
Eckhoff closed his eyes for a moment.
"However, in one of the villages,
Joseph and his nurse were giving penicillin to twins who both had pneumonia. While they were doing this, the father came in. He had just been bitten by a Russell's viper in the water on the rice paddy. Joseph Carlson had one dose of serum left, which he asked the nurse to load into a syringe and give to the man. In the meantime, Joseph went outside to evacuate, as he, like many others, had stomach cramps and diarrhea. While he was crouching in the floodwater, he was bitten in the testicles and screamed so loudly that everyone knew what had happened. When he returned to the house, the nurse said the Chinese heathen refused to let her inject him because if Joseph had also been bitten, he wanted Joseph to have the serum. If Joseph was allowed to live, he reasoned, he could save many children's lives, and he was only a farmer who didn't even have a farm anymore. Eckhoff took a breath. Joseph said he was so frightened he didn't even consider rejecting the offer, and told the nurse to give him the injection at once. Afterward, he began to cry while the Chinese farmer tried to console him. After he'd finally pulled himself together, he asked the nurse to inquire whether the Chinese heathen had heard of Jesus. She didn't even have time to pose the question, because the farmer's trousers started to run red with blood. He died within seconds. Eckhoff watched them as though waiting for the story to sink in. A trained preacher's pause for effect, thought Harry. So the man is burning in hell now? According to Joseph's understanding of the Bible, yes. However, Joseph has renounced religion now. So that was the reason he lost his faith and left the country. That was what he told me. Harry nodded and spoke to the notepad he had taken out. So now Joseph Carlson will burn because he was unable to accept, the paradox about faith. Have I understood correctly? You're moving into a difficult area for theologians, Hole. Are you a Christian? No, I'm a detective. I believe in proof. Which means? Harry sneaked a look at his watch and hesitated before giving a rapid answer, delivered in flat intonation. I have problems with a religion that says faith in itself is enough for a ticket to heaven. In other words, that the ideal is your ability to manipulate your own common sense to accept something your intellect rejects. It's the same model of intellectual submission that dictatorships have used throughout time. The concept of a higher reasoning without any obligation to discharge the burden of proof. The commander nodded. A considered objection, Inspector. And, of course, you are not the first to have made it. Nevertheless, there are a great many far more intelligent people than you or I who believe. Is that not a paradox to you? No, Harry said. I meet a lot of people who are more intelligent than me. Some of them kill for reasons neither you nor I can fathom. Do you think Robert's murder might have been directed against the Salvation Army? The commander's instinctive reaction was to sit bolt upright in his chair. If you think this is the action of a politically motivated group, I doubt it. The Salvation Army line has always been to remain neutral in political matters, and we have been pretty consistent in this. We didn't even come out with a public condemnation of the German occupation during the Second World War. We went about our work as before. Congratulations, Halverson commented dryly, and received a warning glare from Harry. The one invasion we have given our blessing to is that of 1888, Eckhoff said, undaunted, when the Swedish Salvation Army decided to occupy Norway, and we had the first soup station in the poorest working-class district of Oslo, where your police HQ is situated now, you know. No one bears a grudge against you for that, I would imagine, Harry said. It seems to me that the Salvation Army is more popular than ever. Well, yes and no, Eckhoff said. We enjoy the trust of the Norwegian people. We can feel that. But recruitment is so-so. This autumn there were only 11 cadets at the officer training school in Asker, although the residence hall has room for 60. And since it is our policy to adhere to a conservative interpretation of the Bible on issues such as homosexuality, it goes without saying that we are not popular in all quarters. We will catch up, we will. We're just a little slower than our more liberal counterparts. But do you know what? I think in our changing times it doesn't matter so much if some things move a little slower. He smiled at Halverson and Harry in a way that suggested they had expressed agreement. Anyway, younger personnel will take over. With a younger view of things, I assume. At the moment, we are about to appoint a new chief of administration, and some very young candidates have applied. He placed a hand on his stomach. Was Robert one of them? Harry asked. The commander shook his head with a smile. I can say with confidence he was not.
but his brother John is. The appointee will have control over considerable sums of money, among them all our properties, and Robert was not the type you would give that kind of responsibility. He hadn't been to the officer training school either. Are the properties the ones on Göteborgata? We have many. Our own employees live on Göteborgata, while other places, such as on Jakob Olsgata, are used to house refugees from Eritrea, Somalia, and Croatia. Harry looked at his notepad, slapped the pen down on the arm of the chair, and stood up. I think we've taken up enough of your time, Herr Eckhoff. Oh, it wasn't so much. After all, this is a matter that concerns us. The commander followed them to the door. May I ask you a personal question, Hole? The commander asked. Where have I seen you before? I never forget a face, you see. Maybe on the TV or in the paper, Harry said. There was a great deal of fuss about me in connection with the murder of a Norwegian national in Australia. No, I forget those faces. I must have seen you in the flesh. Can you go and get the car? Harry said to Halverson. When Halverson had gone, Harry turned to the commander. I don't know, but the army helped me once, he said. Picked me up off the street one winter's day when I was so drunk that I couldn't look after myself. The soldier who found me wanted to call the police at first, since he thought they could do the job better. However, I explained that I worked for the police, and that would mean the sack. So he took me down to the field hospital, where I was given an injection and a lie to sleep. I owe you all a big debt of gratitude. David Eckhoff nodded. Well, I thought it was something like that, though I didn't want to say. And as far as the gratitude is concerned, I think we should forget it for the time being. We will be indebted to you if you find the person who killed Robert. God bless you, and your work, Hole. Harry nodded and walked into the anteroom, where he remained for a moment, gazing at Eckhoff's closed door. You're very similar, Harry said. Oh, came the woman's deep voice. Was he severe? I mean, in the photograph. 9 years old, said Martina Eckhoff. You did well to recognize me. Harry shook his head. By the way, I meant to get in touch. I wanted to talk to you. Oh? Harry could hear how that sounded and hastened to add, about Per Holman. Is there anything to talk about? She replied with an indifferent shrug of her shoulders, although the temperature of her voice had fallen. You do your job and I do mine. Maybe. But I wanted to say it was not quite the way it may have looked. And how did it look? I told you I cared about Per Holman, and ended up ruining what was left of his family. That's what my job is like sometimes. She was going to answer when the telephone rang. She lifted the receiver and listened. Vestra Aker Church, she replied, Sunday the 21st, at 12 o'clock. Yes. She put down the phone. Everyone will be going to the funeral, she said, flicking through paperwork. Politicians, clergy, and celebs. Everyone wants a chunk of us in our hour of sorrow. The manager of one of our new singers phoned to say his client could sing at the funeral. Well, Harry said, wondering what he was going to say. But the telephone rang again, so he didn't find out. He knew it was time for a quick exit, nodded, and walked toward the door. I've put Ola down for Wednesday in Egertorga, he heard her say behind him. Yes, for Robert. So the question is whether you can do the soup bus with me tonight. In the elevator, he cursed under his breath and rubbed his face with his hands. Then he let out a desperate laugh, the way you laugh at terrible clowns. Robert's office seemed, if possible, even smaller today, and just as chaotic. The Salvation Army flag dominated next to the icy patterns on the window, and the pocket knife was stuck in the desk beside a pile of papers and unopened envelopes. John was sitting at the desk, letting his gaze wander across the walls. It stopped at a picture of Robert and himself. When was that taken? In Østgård, of course. But which summer? In the photograph, Robert was trying to remain serious, but couldn't restrain a smile. His smile seemed unnatural, forced. John had read the newspapers today. It was unreal, although he knew all the details, as if it were all about someone else and not Robert. The door opened. Outside stood a tall, blonde woman in a military green pilot's jacket. Her mouth was narrow and bloodless.
her eyes hard and neutral, her features expressionless. Behind her stood a red-haired, squat man with a round, boyish countenance, and the type of grin that seems to be etched into some people's faces. They greet all news with it, good or bad.
"Who are you?"
asked the woman. "John Carson." When he saw the woman's eyes become even harder, he went on,
"I'm Robert's brother. My apologies,"
the woman said in a monotone, coming into the room and proffering her hand.
"Torrell Lee, police officer with Crime Squad."
Her hand was bone hard but warm.
"This is Officer Ola Lee."
The man nodded and John returned the nod.
"We're sorry about what happened," the woman said, "but since this is a murder case, we have to seal off this room."
John continued nodding while his eyes found their way back to the photo on the wall.
"I'm afraid that means we have to..."
"Oh, yes, of course," John said.
"Sorry, I'm not quite with it."
"Entirely understandable," Torrell Lee replied with a smile. Not a broad, heartfelt smile, but a small, friendly one, appropriate for the situation. John was thinking that the police must have experience of this kind of thing, working with murders and so on, like priests, like his father.
"Have you touched anything?" she asked.
"Touched? No, why would I do that? I've been sitting in the chair." John got up and, without knowing why, pulled the knife out of the desk, folded it and put it in his pocket.
"It's all yours," he said, leaving the room.
The door was closed quietly behind him. He had reached the stairs when he realized it was an idiotic thing to do, to walk off with the knife, and he turned to take it back. Outside the closed door, he heard the woman laughing.
"My goodness, what a shock that gave me. He's the spitting image of his brother. At first I thought I was seeing a ghost."
"They don't look at all similar," said the man.
"You've only seen a photo."
A terrible thought struck John. Flight SK-655 to Zagreb took off from Gardermoen Airport at 10:40 on the dot, banked left over Lake Hurdal, and set a course south toward the navigation tower in Aalborg, Denmark. Since it was an unusually cold day, the atmospheric layer known as the tropopause had sunk so low that the McDonnell Douglas MD-81 was already climbing through it when they were over central Oslo. And since planes in the tropopause leave vapor trails in the sky, he would have seen, if he had looked up from where he was standing and shivering by the phone booths in Jernbanetorget, the plane he had a ticket for. He had left his bag in a luggage locker in Oslo Central Station. Now he needed a hotel room, and he had to complete the job. And that meant he had to have a gun. But how to get hold of one in a town where you don't have a single contact? He listened to the woman in directory assistance, explaining in sing-song Scandinavian English that there were 17 entries in the Oslo telephone book for people under the name of John Carlson, and she was afraid that she could not give him all of them. However, yes, she could give him the number for the Salvation Army. The lady at Salvation Army headquarters said they had a John Carlson, but he was not at work today. He told her he wanted to send him a Christmas present. Did she have his home address?
"Let me see. 4 Göteborgata, post number 0566. Nice that someone is thinking about him, poor thing."
"Poor thing?"
"Yes, his brother was shot dead yesterday."
"Brother?"
"Yes, in Egatorga. It's in today's paper."
He thanked her for her help and hung up. Something touched him on the shoulder and he whirled around. It was the paper cup that explained what the young man wanted. True, the denim jacket was a little grubby, but he was clean-shaven, had a modern hairstyle, substantial clothes and an open, alert gaze. The young man said something, but when he demonstrated with a shrug that he didn't speak Norwegian, the young man broke into perfect English.
"I'm Christopher. I need money for a room tonight, or else I'll freeze to death."
It sounded like something he had learned in a marketing course, a brief and concise message plus his name, to add an effective emotional immediacy. The request came with a broad smile. He shook his head and made to go, but the beggar stood in front of him with the cup.
"Come on, mister. Haven't you ever had to sleep on the street, frozen, dreading the night?"
"As a matter of fact, I have." For one crazy moment, he felt like telling him he had hidden in a water-filled foxhole for 4 days, waiting for a Serbian tank.
"Then you know what I'm talking about, mister."
He answered with a slow nod, stuffed his hand in his pocket, took out a note, and gave it to Christopher without looking.
"You'll sleep on the street anyway, won't you?"
Christopher pocketed the money, nodded and said with an apologetic smile, "Have to make my medicine the priority, mister.
Where do you usually sleep?"
"Down there." The junkie pointed, and he followed the long, slim forefinger. "Container terminal. They're going to build an opera house there in the summer." Christopher flashed another broad smile. "And I love opera. Isn't it a little cold there now? Tonight it might have to be the Salvation Army. They always have a free bed in the hostel."
"Do they?"
He studied the boy. He looked well-groomed, and his smile revealed a set of shining white, even teeth. Nevertheless, he smelled decay. As he listened, he thought he could hear the crunching of 1,000 jaws, of flesh being consumed from inside. 11. Wednesday, December 17th. The Croatian. Halvorsen sat patiently behind the steering wheel, waiting for the car with the Bergen license plate in front of him. Its wheels spun around on the ice as the driver pressed the accelerator to the floor. Harry was talking to Beata on his cell phone.
"What do you mean?" Harry shouted to drown out the noise of the racing engine.
"It doesn't look like it's the same person in these two pictures,"
Beata repeated.
"It's the same wool hat, same raincoat and same neckerchief. It must be the same person."
She didn't answer.
"Beata!"
"The faces are unclear. There's something strange. I'm not quite sure what. Maybe something to do with the light."
"Hmm. Do you think we're on a wild goose chase?"
"I don't know. His position in front of Carlson tallies with the technical evidence. What's all that noise?"
"Bambi on ice. See you."
"Hang on."
Harry hung on.
"There's one more thing," Beata said. "I looked at the other pictures from the day before."
"Yeah?"
"I can't see any faces that match. But there is one small detail. There's a man wearing a yellowish coat, maybe a camel hair coat. He's got a scarf."
"Hmm. A neckerchief, you mean?"
"No. It looks like an ordinary wool scarf. But it's tied in the same way as he, or they, ties the neckerchief. The right-hand side sticks up from the knot. Have you seen it?"
"No.
I've never seen anyone tie a scarf in that way before,"
Beata said.
"Email me the pictures and I'll take a look."
The first thing Harry did upon getting back to the office was to print out Beata's pictures. When he went to the print room to collect them, Gunnar Hagen was already there. Harry nodded, and the two men stood in silence, watching the grey machine spitting out sheet after sheet.
"Anything new?" Hagen asked at length.
"Yes and no," Harry replied.
"The press are on my back. Would be good if we had something to give them."
"Ah, yes, I almost forgot to say, boss. I tipped them off that we were looking for this man."
Harry took one of the printouts from the pile and pointed to the man with the neckerchief.
"You did what?"
Hagen said. "I tipped off the press. To be exact, Darkbladder."
"Without going through me?"
"Routine number, boss. We call them constructive leaks. We say the information is from an anonymous source in the police, so that the newspaper can pretend they have been doing serious investigative journalism. They like that. So they give it more column space than if we had asked them to publish pictures. Now we can get some help from the general public to identify the man, and everyone is happy."
"I'm not whole."
"I'm genuinely sorry to hear that then, boss," Harry said, and underlined the genuineness with a concerned expression.
Hagen glared at him with his upper and lower jaw moving sideways in opposite directions, in a kneading motion that reminded Harry of a ruminant.
"And what is so special about this man?"
Hagen said, snatching the printout from Harry.
"We're not quite sure. Maybe there are many of them. Beata Lern thinks they, well, tie the neckerchief in a particular way."
"That's a cravat knot."
Hagen took another look.
"What about it?"
"What did you say it was, boss?"
"A cravat knot.
Do you mean a tie knot?"
"A Croat knot, man."
"What?
Isn't this basic history?"
"I'd be grateful if you would enlighten me, boss."
Hagen placed his hands behind his back.
"What do you know about the 30 Years' War?"
"Not enough, I suppose."
"During the 30 Years' War, before he marched into Germany, Gustav Adolf, the Swedish king, supplemented his disciplined but small army with what were reckoned to be the best soldiers in Europe. They were the best because they were considered totally fearless. He hired Croat mercenaries. Did you know that the Norwegian word krabat comes from Swedish, and its original meaning was Croat, in other words, a fearless maniac?"
Harry shook his head.
Although the Croatians were fighting in a foreign country and had to wear King Gustav Adolf's uniform, they were allowed to retain a marker to distinguish them from the others, the cavalry neckerchief. It was a neckerchief the Croatians tied in a special way. The item of clothing was adopted and developed further by the French, but they kept the name, which became cravata.
Cravata. Cravat.
Exactly. Thank you, boss. Harry took the last printout of the pictures off the paper tray and studied the man with the scarf Beata had identified.
You may just have given us a clue.
We don't need to thank each other for doing our jobs, Holm. Hagen took the rest of the printouts and marched out. Halvorsen peered up as Harry raced into the office.
Got a lead, Harry said.
Halvorsen sighed. This phrase tended to mean loads of work and nothing to show for it.
I'm going to call Alex in Europol, Harry said.
Halvorsen knew Europol was Interpol's little sister in The Hague, set up by the EU after the terrorist attacks in Madrid in 1998, to focus specifically on international terror and organized crime. What he didn't know was why this Alex was often willing to help Harry when Norway was not in the EU.
Alex, Harry from Oslo, could you check something out for me, please?
Halvorsen listened to Harry asking Alex, in his jerky but effective English, to search the database for offences committed by suspected international criminals in Europe over the last 10 years. Search words, contract killing, and Croatian.
I'll wait, Harry said, and waited.
Then, in surprise,
that many.
He scratched his chin, then asked Alex to add gun and 9mm to the search.
23 hits, Alex. 23 murders with a Croatian as a suspect.
Jesus.
Well, I know that wars create professional hitmen, but nevertheless.
Try Scandinavia.
Nothing?
Okay. Do you have any names, Alex?
None. Hang on a sec.
Harry looked at Halvorsen as though hoping for a few timely words, but Halvorsen just shrugged.
Okay, Alex, Harry said. One last attempt.
He asked him to add red neckerchief or scarf to the search. Halvorsen could hear Alex laughing on the line.
Thanks, Alex. Talk to you soon.
Harry put down the receiver.
Well,
said Halvorsen,
lead gone up in smoke?
Harry nodded. He had slumped a few notches lower in his chair, but then straightened up with a start.
We have to think along new lines. What have we got?
Nothing.
Great. I love blank sheets of paper.
Halvorsen remembered Harry had once said that what separates a good detective from a mediocre one is the ability to forget. A good detective forgets all the times his gut instinct lets him down, forgets all the leads he has believed in that led nowhere, and pitches in, naive and forgetful again, with undiminished enthusiasm. The telephone rang. Harry snatched at the receiver.
Harry!
But the voice at the other end was already in full flow. Harry got up from behind the desk, and Halvorsen could see the knuckles on his hand around the receiver going white.
Wait, Alex. I'll ask Halvorsen to take notes.
Harry held his hand over the receiver and called to Halvorsen. He tried one last time for fun, dropped Croatian, 9mm, and the other things, and searched under Red Scarf, found Zagreb in 2000 and 2001, Munich in 2002, and Paris in 2003. Harry went back to the phone.
This is our man, Alex.
No, I'm not sure, but my gut is, and my head says that two murders in Croatia are not a coincidence. Do you have any further details Halvorsen can jot down? Halvorsen watched Harry gape in astonishment.
What do you mean, no description? If they remembered the scarf, they must have noticed other things.
What?
Normal height. Is that all?
Harry shook his head as he listened.
What's he saying? Halvorsen whispered. Why discrepancies between statements?
Harry whispered back. Halvorsen noted down discrepancies.
Yes, great. Email me the details.
Well, thanks for now, Alex. If you find anything else, such as a suspected haunt or something like that, give me a buzz, okay?
What?
Right. I'll send you a copy of Me and My Wife. Harry hung up and noticed Halvorsen's quizzical stare.
Old joke,
Harry said. Alex thinks all Scandinavian couples make private porn films. Harry dialed another number, discovered while he was waiting for an answer that Halvorsen was still looking at him and sighed,
I've never even been married, Halvorsen.
Magnus Skara had to shout to be heard over the coffee machine, which appeared to be suffering from a serious lung condition. Perhaps there are a number of hitmen from a hitherto unknown gang who wear red scarves as a kind of uniform. Bullshit, drawled Toril Lee, taking her place in the coffee line behind Skara. She was holding an empty mug with the slogan, "The World's Best Mum." Ola Lee gave a little chuckle. He took a seat by the table inside the kitchenette, which functioned as a cafeteria for the crime and vice squads.
Bullshit, said Skara. It could be terrorism, couldn't it? Holy war against the Christians? Muslims? Then all hell would be let loose. Or perhaps it's Los Dagos. They wear red scarves, don't they?
They prefer to be called Spaniards, said Toril Lee.
Basques, said Halverson, sitting at the table across from Ola Lee. Eh? The running of the bulls, San Fermin in Pamplona. The Basque country.
Eta! Shouted Skara. Shit, why didn't we think of them before?
You should write film scripts,
Toril Lee said. Ola Lee was laughing out loud now, but said nothing as usual.
And you two should stick to bank robbers on Rehypnol, Skara mumbled, referring to the fact that Toril Lee and Ola Lee, who were neither married nor related, had come from the robberies unit.
There's just a little detail that terrorists tend to claim responsibility, Halverson said. The four cases we received from Europol were hits, and then it all went quiet afterward. And the victims have generally been involved in something or other. Both the victims in Zagreb were Serbs who had been acquitted of war crimes, and the one in Munich had been threatening the hegemony of a local baron involved in people smuggling, and the guy in Paris was a pedophile with two previous convictions. Harry Hole wandered in with a mug in his hand. Skara, Lee, and Lee filled their cups and, instead of sitting down, ambled off. Halverson had noticed that Harry had that effect on colleagues. The inspector sat down, and Halverson saw the troubled furrow in his brow.
Soon be 24 hours, Halverson said.
Yes, said Harry, staring into his still empty mug. Is anything the matter?
Harry paused.
I don't know. I called Bjarne Müller in Bergen to get some constructive ideas.
What did he say?
Not a great deal. He sounded, Harry searched for the word, lonely.
Isn't his family with him?
They were supposed to follow.
Trouble?
Don't know. I don't know anything.
What's bothering you then?
He was drunk.
Halverson knocked his mug of coffee and spilled it.
Müller? Drunk at work? You're kidding.
Harry didn't answer.
Maybe he wasn't well or something like that, Halverson added.
I know what a drunken man sounds like, Halverson. I have to go to Bergen.
Now? You're leading a murder investigation, Harry.
I'll be there and back in a day. You hold the fort in the meantime.
Halverson smiled. Are you getting old, Harry?
Old? What do you mean?
Old and human. That's the first time I've heard you give the living priority over the dead.
The instant Halverson saw Harry's face, he was filled with regret.
I didn't mean...
That's fine, Harry said, standing up. I want you to get hold of the passenger lists of all flights to and from Croatia over the last few days. Ask the police at Gardermoen Airport whether you need a prosecutor to make an application. Should you need a court order, pop over to the court and get it on the spot. When you have the lists, call Alex in Europol and ask him to check the names for us. Say it's for me.
And you're sure he can help?
Harry nodded. In the meantime, Beata and I will go have a chat with John Carlson.
Oh?
So far all we've heard about Robert Carlson is pure Disney. I think there's more.
Why aren't you taking me along?
Because Beata, unlike you, knows when people are lying.
He breathed in before tackling the steps up to the restaurant called Biscuit. The difference from the previous evening was that there were almost no people around, but the same waiter was leaning against the door to the dining room, the one with the Georgi curls and the blue eyes.
Hello there, said the waiter. I didn't recognize you.
He blinked twice, caught unawares by the fact that it meant he had been recognized.
But I recognize the coat, the waiter said, very stylish. Is it camel hair?
I hope so, he stammered with a smile. The waiter laughed and placed a hand on his arm. He didn't see a trace of fear in the man's eyes and concluded the waiter was without suspicions, and hoped that meant the police had not been here and therefore had not found the gun.
I don't want to eat, he said. I just want to use the bathroom.
The bathroom? Repeated the waiter, and he saw the blue eyes scanning his.
You came here to use the bathroom?
Really?
A quick visit, he said, swallowing. The waiter's presence made him uneasy.
A quick visit? Repeated the waiter.
I see. The men's room was empty and smelled of soap, but not freedom. The smell of soap was even stronger when he flipped up the lid of the soap dispenser. He rolled up his sleeve and thrust his hand down into the cold green mush. For an instant, a thought shot through his mind, that they had changed soap dispensers. But then he felt it. Slowly he fished it out, and the soap dripped long green fingers on the white porcelain basin. After a rinse and a little oil, the gun would be fine, and he still had 6 bullets in the magazine. He hurriedly rinsed the gun and was about to put it in his coat pocket when the door opened.
"Hello again,"
the waiter whispered with a big smile, but the smile went rigid when he caught sight of the gun. He slipped it into his pocket, mumbled a goodbye, and forced his way past the waiter in the narrow doorway. He felt rapid breathing against his face and the other man's erection on his thigh. It was only when he was out in the cold again that he became aware of his heart. It was pounding, as though he had been frightened. The blood streamed through his body, making him feel warm and light. John Carson was on his way out as Harry arrived on Göteborgata.
"Is it that late?"
John asked with a glance at his watch, confused.
"I'm a little early," Harry said. "My colleague will be along in a moment. Do I have time to buy some milk?"
He was wearing a thin jacket and his hair was combed.
"By all means."
The corner shop was on the other side of the street, and while John was rummaging for the change to buy a quart of low-fat milk, Harry studied the lavish selection of Christmas decorations between the toilet paper and the cereal boxes. Neither of them commented on the newspaper stand by the cash desk, on which the Egatorga murder screamed out at them in bold capitals. The front page of Dagbladet carried a blurred, grainy crop of Vedlog's picture of the crowd, with a red circle around the head of the person with the scarf, and the headline, "Police seek this man." They went out and John stopped in front of a beggar with red hair and a 70s goatee. He searched long and hard in his pocket until he found something he could drop in the brown paper cup.
"I don't have much to offer you," John said to Harry, "and to tell the truth, the coffee has been standing in the percolator for a while. Probably tastes like tar."
"Great. That's just how I like it."
"You too."
John Carlson gave a pale smile.
"Ow."
John held his head and turned to the beggar.
"Are you throwing money at me?"
he asked in astonishment. The beggar snorted into his beard in annoyance and shouted in a clear voice,
"Legal tender only, thank you."
John Carlson's flat was identical to Thea Nielsen's. It was clean and tidy, but the interior still bore the unmistakable signs of bachelorhood. Harry drew 3 quick assumptions. That the old but well-looked-after furniture came from the same place as his, namely Elevator, the second-hand shop on Ulle Volsveien. That John had not been to the art exhibition, the solitary poster on the sitting room wall was advertising, and that more meals were eaten, bent over the low table in front of the TV, than in the place provided in the kitchenette. On the almost empty bookshelf, there was a photograph of a man in a Salvation Army uniform, looking out into space with an authoritative air.
"Your father?"
Harry asked.
"Yes,"
John answered, taking 2 mugs from the kitchen cupboard and pouring from a stained brown coffee jug.
"You look very similar."
"Thank you," said John.
"I hope that's true."
He brought the mugs in and deposited them on the coffee table next to the fresh carton of milk. Harry was going to ask how his parents had taken the news of Robert's death, but changed tack.
"Let's begin with the hypothesis," Harry said, "that your brother was killed because he had done something to someone. Tricked them, borrowed money from them, insulted them, threatened them, hurt them, or whatever. Your brother was a good guy. Everyone says that. And that's what we tend to hear in murder cases. People like to emphasize the good sides. Most of us have dark sides, though, don't we?"
John nodded, although Harry was unable to decide whether this was a sign of agreement or not.
"What we need is some light shed on Robert's dark sides."
John stared, uncomprehending. Harry cleared his throat.
"Let's start with money. Did Robert have any financial problems?"
John shrugged. "No, and yes. He didn't exactly live in style, so I can't imagine he had incurred huge debts, if that's what you mean. By and large, he borrowed from me if he needed money, I think. By borrowing, I mean..."
John's smile was wistful. "What sort of sums are we talking about?"
"Not big ones. Apart from this autumn.
How much?
30,000.
For what purpose?
John scratched his head. He had a project, but wouldn't expand on it. Just said he would need to travel abroad. I would find out, he said. Yes, I thought it was quite a lot of money, but I live cheaply and I don't have a car. And for once, he seemed so enthusiastic. I was curious about what it was, but then, well, then this happened.
Harry took notes.
What about Robert's darker sides as a person?
He waited, studied the coffee table and let John sit and think while the vacuum of silence took effect. The vacuum that sooner or later always elicited something. A lie, a despairing digression, or, in the best-case scenario, the truth.
When Robert was young, he was...
John ventured, then stopped.
Harry, motionless, said nothing. He lacked inhibition.
Harry nodded without looking up, gave encouragement without disturbing the vacuum.
I used to dread what he might be up to. He was so violent. There seemed to be two people inside him. One was the cold, controlled, investigative type who was curious about, what should I say, reactions, feelings, suffering too, perhaps, that sort of thing.
Can you give me any examples? Harry asked.
John swallowed. Once, when I came home, he said he had something to show me in the laundry room in the cellar. He had put our cat in a small empty aquarium where Dad had kept guppies and stuffed the end of the garden hose in under a wooden lid on the top. Then he turned the tap on full. Things moved so fast that the aquarium was almost full before I managed to remove the lid and rescue the cat. Robert said he wanted to see how the cat would react, but now and then I have wondered whether it was in fact me he was observing.
If he was like that, it's strange no one mentioned it.
Not many people knew that side of Robert. I suppose it was partly my own fault. From the time we were small, I had to promise Dad I would keep an eye on Robert so that he didn't get into any real trouble. I did what I could. Robert's behavior was, as I said, not out of control. He could be hot and cold at the same time, if you understand. So only those closest to him had a sense of Robert's other sides. Well, and the occasional frog.
John smiled.
He launched them into the air in helium balloons. When Dad caught him, Robert said it was so sad to be a frog and never be able to get a bird's eye view. And I...
John stared into space, and Harry could see his eyes becoming moist.
I started to laugh. Dad was furious, but I couldn't help myself. Robert could make me laugh like that.
Did he grow out of this?
John shrugged. To be honest, I don't know everything Robert has been doing in recent years. Since Mum and Dad moved to Thailand, Robert and I have not been so close.
Why is that?
That sort of thing often happens between brothers. There doesn't have to be any reason.
Harry didn't answer, just waited. A door slammed in the hallway.
There were a few incidents with girls,
John said. The distant sound of ambulance sirens, an elevator with a metallic hum. John breathed out with a sigh.
Young girls.
How young?
I don't know.
Unless Robert was lying, they must have been very young. Why would he lie?
As I said, I think he liked to see how I would react.
Harry stood up and went over to the window. A man was ambling across Sophienberg Park, along a path that looked like an uneven brown line drawn by a child on a white piece of paper. To the north of the church was a small enclosed cemetery for the Jewish community. Stola Orner, the psychologist, had once told him that hundreds of years ago the whole park had been a cemetery.
Was he violent toward any of these girls?
Harry asked.
No.
John's exclamation echoed among the bare walls. Harry said nothing. The man had left the park and was crossing Helgesensgata toward their building.
Not as far as I know,
John said. And if he had told me he had been, I wouldn't have believed him. Do you know any of the girls he met?
No.
He never stayed with them for long. As a matter of fact, there was just one girl I know he was serious about.
Oh, Thea Nielsen.
He was obsessed with her when we were young boys.
Your girlfriend?
John gazed thoughtfully into his coffee cup.
You would think I could keep away from the one girl my brother had made his mind up he would have, wouldn't you? And God knows I have wondered why.
And?
All I know is that Thea is the most fantastic person I've ever met.
The hum of the elevator came to a sudden stop.
Did your brother know about you and Thea?
He found out that we had met a couple of times. He had his suspicions, but Thea and I have been trying to keep it a secret. There was a knock at the door.
"That'll be Beata, my colleague," Harry said. "I'll get it."
He turned over his notepad, placed his pen parallel to it, and walked the few steps to the front door. He struggled for a few seconds until he realized it opened inward. The face he met was as surprised as his own, and for a moment they stood looking at each other. Harry noticed a sweet, perfumed smell, as if the other person used a strong aromatic deodorant.
"John?" the man asked tentatively.
"Of course," Harry said.
"Sorry, we were expecting someone else. One moment."
Harry went back to the sofa.
"It's for you."
The instant he flopped down into the soft cushion, it struck Harry that something had happened, right now, in the last few seconds. He checked that his pen was still parallel with the pad, untouched. But there was something. His brain had detected something he couldn't place.
"Good evening,"
he heard John say behind him. Polite, reserved form of address. Rising intonation. The way you greet someone you don't know, or when you don't know what they want. There it was again. Something happened. Something grated. There was something about him. He had used John's first name when he asked after him, but it was obvious John didn't know him.
"What message?" John said.
Then it clicked into place. The neck. The man was wearing something around his neck. A neckerchief. The cravat knot. Harry put both hands on the coffee table to lever himself up, and the cups went flying as he screamed, "Shut the door!" But John stood staring through the doorway as if hypnotized. He stooped to listen. Harry stepped back one pace, jumped over the sofa, and sprinted for the door.
"Don't!"
John said. Harry aimed and launched himself. Then everything seemed to stop. Harry had experienced it before, when the adrenaline kicks in and changes your perception of time. It was like moving in water, and he knew it was too late. His right shoulder hit the door, his left, John's hip, and his eardrum received the sound waves of the exploding gunpowder and a bullet leaving a gun. Then came the bang, the bullet, the door slamming into the frame and locking, John hitting the cupboard and the kitchen unit. Harry swiveled onto his side and looked up. The door handle was being pressed down.
"Fuck!"
Harry whispered, getting to his knees. The door was shaken hard, twice. Harry grabbed John's belt and dragged him, lifeless, over the parquet floor to the bedroom. There was a scratching sound outside the door, then another bang. Splinters flew from the middle of the door. One of the cushions on the sofa jerked. A column of grayish-black down rose to the ceiling, and the carton of low-fat milk began to gurgle. A jet of milk described a weak, white arc onto the table. "The damage a 9mm projectile can do is underrated," thought Harry, turning John onto his back. One drop of blood ran from a hole in his forehead. Another bang. The tinkle of glass. Harry flipped his cell out of his pocket and punched in Beata's number.
"Okay, okay, don't hassle me. I'm coming,"
Beata answered after the first ring.
"I'm outside."
"Listen," Harry interrupted. "Radio or patrol cars to get here now. With their sirens blaring, someone is outside the flat peppering us with lead, and you keep away. Received?"
"Received. Stay on the line."
Harry put the cell on the floor in front of him. Scraping sound against the wall. Could he hear them? Harry sat motionless. The scraping came nearer. What kind of walls were they? A bullet that could go through an insulated front door would have no problems with a stud wall of plasterboard and fiberglass. Even nearer. It stopped. Harry held his breath. And that was when he heard. John was breathing. Then a sound rose from the general rumble of city noise, and it was music to Harry's ears. A police siren. Two police sirens. Harry listened for scraping. Nothing.
"Make a run for it," he prayed. "Beat it."
And was heard. The sound of footsteps down the corridor and the stairs. Harry lay back on the cold parquet floor and stared at the ceiling. There was a draft coming from under the door. He closed his eyes.
19 years. Christ.
19 years until he could go into retirement. 12. Wednesday, December 17th. Hospital and Ashes.